Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the cardiologist Jane Somerville. Now an emeritus professor in her discipline at Imperial College London, she has gained a worldwide reputation for her pioneering work on congenital heart disease. She began studying medicine in the early 1950s when only a very few women were admitted through the doors of med school. It's really just as well they let her in. She's been responsible for groundbreaking advances in cardiovascular treatment and founded the hugely successful World Congress of Paediatric Cardiology. She had something of a role model in her mother, a hard-working, very clever, successful woman too. And her early years as a pupil at a boys' school in Wales must surely also have prepared her for making her way in such a heavily male-dominated profession. She has a reputation for being straight-talking, and her late husband used to urge her to be more prudent. But she says, it wasn't fun to be prudent. It's much more fun to be mafioso and naughty. Now, mafioso and naughty, Jane, probably not the two words that people would associate with somebody in your profession. Tell me more about that characteristic.
Oh, well, I think those who know me well would know the naughty part, because I think that I've always been rather anti-establishment and also rather blunt, because I never thought I had much time to make my point, so I did it quickly and, as my children say, rudely. You had to be very naughty if you were with naughty boys at school. If you weren't naughty too, you didn't get noticed, or you certainly didn't get your points over. So I think the training came at boys' school during the war.
As recently as, I don't know, 30-odd, maybe 40 years ago, 9 out of 10 babies born with heart defects died in childhood. Today, 8 out of 10 live. How does it feel to be, in a very large part, responsible for the fact that there are thousands of people walking around this earth who wouldn't otherwise be here?
Well, I think I'm not responsible. It's really the cardiac surgeons who are responsible. I always wanted to be one, but I never made it, as I'm completely unconnected head to hands. But I think I've looked after a lot of patients who've grown up and survived and tried to help them live as normal lives as possible.
I'm wondering about the unit specifically that you set up for teenagers and adults. Why did you see that it was care that needed to be done there that wasn't being taken care of?
When I was briefly a cardiac surgeon for a year at Guy's with Sir Russell, then to become Lord Brock, I realised that whatever they were doing, if they did survive, that there was an awful lot of abnormality left in the heart. So way back I was worried as to what would happen to the patients if they were lucky enough to survive the surgery, leave the hospital and even grow up. And I didn't really think that surgeons understood. They thought that that was it, finished. They had, in fact, totally corrected. Well, most of the things they don't totally correct at all. They leave a lot of abnormality behind. So that thought came into my head.
Is it true that at one point in your consulting room you had a leopard skin chaise longue?
I think it actually pony skin, but it's more or less true, yes. I had it in my office and used to lie there thinking.
You are now officially retired, given that you're 80 years old now. I want to know what you do with your months then. Are you sort of gardening and sitting with your feet up?
No, certainly I'm not. I'm running around the world giving lectures. I love travel. I'm hungry to know more things and train more people.
I've been told that you say to women who you have inspired and who may want to follow in your footsteps that rule number one is never iron a shirt.
Certainly, that is a rule. I don't think we have time to be running around feeling guilty ironing men's shirts. Someone else can do that, as I made clear to my beloved husband when he produced a shirt. So I plonked the iron on it and burnt the sleeve. So that was that. No more were given to me.
Time for some music then, Jane Somerville. Tell me about your first one this morning. What are we going to hear?
Well, I hope we're going to hear the Habanero, which
yes.
Has everything amazing. And I remember first hearing that at the boys' school when we had an hour once or twice a week where we listened to music. And I can remember thinking, this is something else. I love this. And that was my first introduction to what I think is strong romantic music.
Habanera from Bizet's Carmen, sung there by Leontine Price. So, Jane Somerville, you were born in Kensington in 1933. What are your earliest memories of life at home?
Well, we lived in a house which is now the Prince's Trust, and I can remember sort of walking down. I had a governess, don't ask me why I didn't go to little school. And when I complained that we should get a taxi and not walk, I've never liked walking anywhere, she said, "You've got taxi legs, and it's time they were used." And I can remember going to Major Sulk, it's one of my earliest memories. And then I remember when the war started, the searchlights, because I was there in the beginning, just before all children were ordered out of London.
And tell me about your mother. I said in the introduction, you know, she, for her generation, rather untypically, she was a working woman. What did she do?
She was one of these school refusers and went to about 13 schools until my grandfather said, "You educate yourself." So she got a scholarship to Bedford College to read Saxon on her own and mathematics. And then she saw an advertisement and went off to help establish women's army services in the First World War behind the lines, where I think there was considerable fun and games, and then into the Roaring Twenties. And she became assistant to the editor of Vogue, which came out. And her job was to get the copy out of Aldous Huxley.
And she knew Aldous Huxley well, didn't she?
I think extremely well.
Yes, I was going to say there was more than copy passed between them.
Oh, I think so. They wrote The Gioconda Smile together, and I think he dedicated Chrome Yellow to her.
Those were her achievements. What was her character like? How would you describe her character?
Highly intelligent, tolerant, very witty, very sharp-tongued, and knew where she was going.
If she, I mean, obviously if she was working, she wasn't in the house all of the time. Did you feel that when she was there, you sort of had to work to get her interest?
Probably, because I didn't apparently eat my food until she came home, so I imagine there was some attention-seeking then. She'd come home at 5 or 6 o'clock and find me still eating my lunch with an insistent nanny.
And where was your father?
Well, I think that he sort of left. I was quite interested to meet him and never did. I was in Guy's Hospital, my medical school, and he wrote me a postcard and we agreed to meet, I remember very well, at Fortnum and Mason's. I've always liked that. And he didn't turn up. And I thought, right, that's that. Here the mafioso. I will not have anything to do with that man, even if he wants to. So that was the end of that. It didn't rank in my life at all.
And does that matter?
Not to me, but I suspect in some way, you know, I don't do with psychobabble, but it might have started the rather ribald attitude I have to men, and it might have also influenced me to marry a mature man as some sort of substitute, which I never thought I wanted.
Let's have some more music, Jane Somerville. It's time for your second disc.
This was another listen at school. I probably didn't listen. I was probably playing with my friend Gillian, my best friend, and we're still best friends. And I heard this horn concerto, and ever since then I have loved the sound of the French horn. And I remember asking for my birthday for the record.
Was the rondo from Mozart's Horn Concerto No. 4 in E-flat major, performed there by Dennis Brain. So, Jane Somerville, you were round about 6, I think, when you were told you had to escape the bombs of London. You were dispatched, along with one of your cousins, to a prep school in Port Merion in Wales. How did you feel about that at the time?
I think I'd been brought up in a way that, with a stern governess, that you went where you were sent. And also, you know, it was emergency. Awful leaving mother behind, and on the occasions when we came home, one had to go back from Paddington on the troop train. And I can remember being told, "You must get up if there's a soldier in the corridor and let him sit down. He's going to fight for you." So then we went up to Wales and the war was forgotten. There are all sorts of interesting people staying in Port Marion, hibernating from the war or whatever. It was a lovely place.
And in the school itself, mostly boys, of course, it was a boys' prep school. Yes, how did you get on there?
Oh, I thought it was the best thing ever. We had five or six girls in one dormitory, and the boys were extremely naughty, and why not join them, I thought. They were rather dismissive of girls, but, you know, one learnt that. They are rather dismissive of girls until they find they have a use. But we played cricket, and we had to wear those horrible little hairy Harris tweed shorts, which I thought were quite ghastly, chafing your legs. It was great fun. I had a great war up there 3 years. And then I think the headmaster thought, enough girls. And so I came back to London.
And, of course, the war would still have been on. How was it to come from the calm of Wales back into the war?
Rather dramatic. The flying bombs were flying about. And I remember taking the 73 bus from Kensington. And you had to get off the bus when you heard this. And it was a bit hairy, but I don't know, one just got on with life.
When you were 13, is it true you used to read medical books on your holidays?
Yes, it's true. I was sent off in school holidays to an aunt in Saffron Walden. Rather boring, I thought. Anyhow, I'd be there, and I saw these books in the shelves, dusty books, so I thought, ooh, what's that? I must have a look. It looks interesting. So I would concentrate on certain parts of the anatomy, and I learnt a lot. I thought, hoo-hoo, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to know all this stuff. So that's how it began.
Did your mother talk to you about what you should do with your
Never.
Life?
She was so relieved that I knew. And to her surprise, because I was quite young, I got into medical school at Guy's Hospital. Interviewed by the one-eyed dean with a black monocle. It was terribly exciting. And he said, you're very young. Do you think you can cope with all the men around? I said, oh, yeah, I'm used to that. It's no problem for me.
Is it true that his monocle popped out?
Yes, it did.
Do you think he was doing
it
sort of...
he left an empty socket. He'd been wounded in the First World War. It is true.
It's time for your third piece of music. Ooh. What are we going to hear now? Why have you chosen this?
When I first went to the London Theatre, I remember Mother taking me to Lady Behave. Of course, it was quite marvellous. And I thought, ooh, this is something else with all the plush velvet. And then the next show I completely fell in love with was Me and My Girl. And it ends happily. I like romance to end happily.
Once you get down Lambeth Way, any evening, any day, you'll find yourself doing the Lambeth Way. Any time you're Lambeth Way, any evening, any day, you'll find yourself doing the Lambeth Way. Hey, the little Lambeth Way, take along the Lambeth Way.
That was Lupino Lane and a chorus from the audience, I think, performing there The Lambeth Walk from Me and My Girl. You mentioned as we went into that, Jane Somerville, that you do like romances to have a happy ending. Let's talk about the happy beginning of yours. When did you first meet the man you would later go on to marry?
Oh, when I was at school. He had digs lower down in Edward Square with a rather mad landlady, and he used to eat at my next door neighbour's. And I used to climb over the garden wall and eat there too, in the way one was sort of rebelling against one's own family. And that's where I met him.
So you would have been how old?
16. He would have been 36, just come back from the war and working in Hammersmith in the postgraduate school there.
So you were 16 and you were sweet on him, and what did he sort of tell you, don't be a silly girl?
The first encounter was, I said I wanted to do medicine. So he said, well, you really ought to go to Oxbridge. And I didn't get in. He said, and then you should go to Guy's or Bart's. They're only two sensible teaching hospitals. I still have that letter that he wrote to me from Paris. And then we didn't meet again. He used to take the girl next door out, and I used to go and let my bulldog out and disturb the romance in Edward Square. But anyway, I didn't meet him again till I was just qualified.
Is it true that he was so handsome that he was asked to screen test for MGM?
Yes, in New York. Yes, it is true.
Did he? Did he screen
no,
test?
No, he said, I want to do medicine.
So he had these matinee idol looks.
Yes, yes, he had matinee idol. I don't know, matinee, it depends what matinee, doesn't it? Yeah, he was good looking, and his children are good looking.
And were you one of those young women who thought, one day that will be the man I will marry?
I wasn't. I had plenty of men around for one reason or another. I thought he was the best of them.
And you were...
I didn't think about marriage. I only thought about my career. So any man had to fall in with that and pay for the necessary. I knew that then.
You became a medical student then at Guy's Hospital.
I did, in the second year, so I was qualified by the time I was 21.
How many girls had they let in?
9%, right. By order of the government.
Ah.
And the senior physician, who was a real woman hater and all that went with it, who trailed around with his retinue of boys, would swear as you passed them in the park. There's another of those women. I better not swear on the radio, but you'd hear it. I used to just cock my nose in the air and say, poof.
You begged to be taken under the wing of Sir Russell Brock. Now, for those of us who haven't spent a life in medicine, tell us who he is and what his reputation was.
Well, he was one of the great surgeons who moved to cardiac surgery. So he did the early blue babies because of this connection with Alfred Blaylock, who came to lecture at Guy's. And I completely became entranced with this matter of blue babies. No, they weren't babies then, blue people being turned to pink people by Blaylock's operation. And I said, that's for me.
More in just a minute, Jane Somerville. For now, though, we must fit in the music. It's time for your fourth.
Well, there were these wonderful shows. There was Ivan Novello, there was Noel Card. You know, I witnessed Noel Card introducing Marlene Dietrich at the last performance. I had a boyfriend. We used to go to the Café de Paris. And it was very exciting, all these romantic things going on and all these marvellous people making great songs. And I love Noel Card. I love the wit.
When he bellowed, "Che bella signorina," sheer ecstasy at once produced a wild shriek from Mrs. Wentworth Brewster, changing her whole demeanour. When both her daughters and her son said, "Please come home, Mama," she answered rather bibulously, "Who do you think you are? Nobody can afford to be so la-di-bloody-dar in a bar on the Piccola Marina."
That was Noel Coward and a bar on the Piccola Marina. So tell me a bit more, Jane Somerville. The phrase you used was turning blue babies to pink babies, which is not just wonderfully descriptive, but of course makes it sound rather simple. You were at the pioneering front of this sort of surgery when you were working with Sir Russell Brock. What was it like working for him?
It was fantastic. It was like one long episode of MASH. It was incredibly exciting. Every day, something new, because that was late 50s, was cardiac surgery was beginning to emerge. It was a bit of a nightmare, and we'd be all day in the theatre, and one didn't really know what was going on, and there was no book to help you, and there was no intensive care, and you slept in the ward, and Brock would arrive at 7 o'clock in the morning and say, "How's the patient?" and you didn't dare tell him. So the whole thing was incredibly exciting. But after about a year, I realised my hands were not connected to my head.
Can you give me an indication of outcomes at that time? You know, the amount of people...
Awful.
Yes.
I remember we did 11 or 10 blue children. The first one survived, I think really by chance, and the next 8 or 9 died. It was absolutely awful. But somehow, when it was successful, it was so amazing. One knew one was really trying. And the actual outcome of the patient retaining their same disease without surgery was also very bad.
So tell me then about setting up this Paul Wood Special Adolescent Unit at the National Heart Hospital. You were given the space to do it, but you weren't given the funding.
When I got on the staff of the heart hospital, that was a bit of a battle. But anyhow, I got on as a physician for congenital heart disease, which was lovely because I could have children and adults. And then we had the need for adolescents because in Great Ormond Street, they were getting lots of survivors. And Dick Bonham Carter, who was very smart, realised that they needed care, that they had residual things and so on and so forth. So he'd send them to me.
How did you fund this ward?
By chance. You know, if you take advantage of chance, it was given by an anonymous donor who I was introduced to by actually my husband when we were having a glass of champagne, eat smoked salmon. He said, "Do you need money for your work?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I do." So the generous donor gave us about £60,000, which was quite a lot in 1975.
You qualified at the age of 21, as you mentioned. You weren't made a consultant until you were 38. Why do you think that was?
I think for several reasons. Firstly, I didn't have a Y chromosome, you know, I'm not male, so I never got on a shortlist. The second thing is I was mad about congenital heart disease, so I was half an adult cardiologist and really half a paediatric cardiologist, and really not accepted by either. The paediatric cardiologist didn't accept me because I hadn't done paediatrics. I mean, what do I need to know about changing nappies, eczema and all that stuff, I felt. So I decided I was going to design my own specialty. And then there'd only be me, and that more or less is what's happened.
Was it your impression throughout those years that the medical establishment wanted you out?
I thought there was prejudice against me, who was very mouthy and upset a lot of people. Rebel with a cause I was, not a rebel with no cause.
Didn't you ever think about buttoning it in order to get further?
Walter would encourage that, but by then I had children. I was running round like a baby steam engine, running between children and husband. Yeah, I did think about it, but one's thoughts don't always get to one's mouth, you know.
Ain't that the truth? Right, let's have some more music. We're on your fifth disc. Tell me about this choice.
Well, by the time I discovered the Russian national anthem, this would be in the 80s, I was rushing to and fro around the world and giving lectures in between the rest of the things one was supposed to do in a hysterical way. And I discovered Moscow, which was the most exciting place.
That was the Red Army Choir singing the Russian national anthem. So, Jane Somerville, you used a great phrase a moment ago, running around like a baby steam engine. You had this very, very demanding job. You had a husband who also was flying in his career, doing very well as a cardiologist too, and you had four children. Women these days are preoccupied with the life-work balance. What was your life-work balance like?
Disordered. I think that I was rather hysterical and bad-tempered when I got home and hungry. Runs in the family, we get rather low blood sugar. And so the children did suffer a bit, but they were tolerant. And I had a wonderful housekeeper called Maggie, and she sort of kept rule of the roost. And then we had nannies, a number of them, some of them mad, some of them bad, and some of them rather sweet.
Were you the sort of mother who was able to turn up at prize-giving days or sports days or concerts?
Well, I occasionally did, but I think my children would say not too often. Sometimes they'd come and talk to me. I had a step made in my bathroom where I spent a lot of time in the bath, so the kids would come in and sit on the step and tell me their troubles, and I might tell them mine. Or actually, the World Congress thought was born in the bath. I can't have had any children around.
Yes, this was a genuine eureka moment the bath.
There was.
Tell me more.
Children could say they suffered because I wasn't a very hands-on mother, fussing about everything, giving them everything they want. I think these children who are overindulged in the end will suffer because actually life doesn't provide all that for you. So I think mine are a little bit hardy. They went off to boarding school. We were sent away. We weren't given mother's milk. I hear this. You know, we had one sock and I don't listen to all that. They were all right.
Let's talk about your eureka moment then. You were in the bath and you thought, yes, I'm going to start the World Congress of Paediatric Cardiology.
Well, it was more complicated than that. It was so exciting, the specialty. And there were all these advances all the time, you know, and lots to talk about. The adult cardiologists weren't interested in what we had to say at all. They turned off, so we didn't get space. So I thought, right, the only thing to do is to have our own congress. And I got out of the bath. And it took place in 1980. It took us 5 years to get it together in Wembley, the most ghastly conference centre man could invent. But it was fun, and we galloped around, and people came from every part of the world. I think 1,300 delegates came.
Can you give me an indication of the change, the sort of graph, if you like, in outcomes between, you know, 40 years ago and now?
Oh, well, of course, it's amazed. As you started off, I mean, the natural history of people born with heart disease was perhaps 15% would lead adolescents. Now, 1995. Even the most severe lesions can now be operated on. A number of them need long-term care. That's why the need for grown-up congenital heart specialty is very important now because we've got so many survivors.
Let's have some more music then, Jane Somerville. We're on your sixth piece of the morning. Tell me about this.
Well, this is part of the romantic era of when Walter and I were meeting. We married in 1957 and we went dancing, and I love Cheek to Cheek.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven.
That was Fred Astaire singing Cheek to Cheek from the movie Top Hat. So, Jane Somerville, we've heard about how important Walter Somerville, who went on to be your husband, was in your life, himself an eminent cardiologist. He died in 2005. Given your long and happy union, how have you coped without him?
Well, I've always been hungry for many different things as well as food. And so there's been a lot to do, and I still run around the world and I see my unicorns. I've trained a number of people and they're all around and they want to see you. And
yes, tell me why they're called the unicorns, this bunch of people.
Because I used to say to them, you've got to have an imagination. Would you recognise a unicorn if you saw one? Can't you just think and use your imaginations? We're dealing with new medicine. We're dealing with things we haven't seen before. They are very devoted and people come and go through the house, as they always have done, much to the resentment of my children who found all these foreign people at meals. And life has gone on, and it was quite clear with 20 years between us that I was going to be a widow. So I always decided if I was going to be a merry widow.
None of your children have followed you in to medicine.
They grew up with all this at breakfast, lunch and tea. They got fed up with Walter and I discussing this, that and the other and the interesting things. And I think they were turned off it. They all would have made good doctors. They're amazingly knowledgeable and sensible. But the heritage has really stopped. The health service is not what it was, although I once upon a time loved it. It's appalling, except lovely in bits.
You worked in the NHS for more than half a century, and you just said there it's appalling. I mean, that's very strong terms. What do you think is appalling about the NHS?
Well, I think this erratic care. I think Staffordshire is not alone. I think there are some wonderful things that happen in the health service, and it should always be free at the point of entry. And I think it's been ruined, I regret to say, initiated by Margaret Thatcher, who thought she could run it like grocery stores and introduce managers. We've lost the matron, we've lost the senior sister. Also, machines have taken over, so they're not trained. The art of medicine has been lost.
We have seen unmatched numbers in terms of funding going into the health service, though, in the last 15 years.
Absolutely, going in the wrong place and employing managers. Running around with clipboards, not understanding clinical priorities and interfering with them. I personally think doctors should decide on clinical priorities.
Tell me more about the art of medicine then. What do you think there is to celebrate in good medicine well practiced in our NHS?
Well, I think you have to be knowledgeable, but I think the art of medicine is to understand what's the matter with the patient. Some attempt should be made other than asking a machine.
Let's have some more music. You're seventh. What are we going to hear?
Well, this is important. This is part of my latter life since I was spending time in Paris. I met Thomas Hampson and I loved his voice. And then of the past, I just adore Cole Porter. It was all part of the romantic musical talent that I have always adored.
Night and day.
That was Thomas Hampson singing Night and Day. Jane, you said an intriguing thing a moment ago. I'm determined to play the Merry Widow. Are you very merry?
Perhaps not in the way the Merry Widow was by Franz Lehár, but I enjoy my life. I think I'm only here once. I enjoy my children now, particularly now they're grown up and not squawking. I love being with them all, perhaps not at the same time. I love going around the world to lecture in funny places and in lovely places. I'm very, very lucky.
I noticed at the beginning when we started talking this morning that you were loath to take, it's interesting, isn't it, too much credit for anything really, but I'm going to force you to sort of look at your career, look at the contribution that you have made and try to think of the single best development in cardiac treatments that you think, I think I made quite a difference there.
Well, I think I made a difference to the specialisation that people had to realise. They had to look after people with congenital heart disease who grew up. And I think I've taught perhaps more than one generation really about conducting medicine and looking after patients. Patients are my passion. I felt very sorry for them when they were born with these things that went on. And I've had a lovely family, so I've made a few contributions that I'm very, very proud and pleased with.
Did your mother live to see the career you were building for yourself?
No, she didn't. No, she didn't. But she always believed I would if I wanted. I've always had this rather gritty, obstinate determination, so I think she knew I would.
Yes. What do you think she would have made of your life?
I think she'd be very pleased. She never went on about things too much. There was never all this, oh, how marvellous, you've got your homework right and you got an A star. None of that occurred. Just get on and do it.
Given the sort of person you are, I'm wondering how you are with your grandchildren. I mean, when they come in and say, Grandma, I got an A star, do you sit them on
your... No. I'm a fairly hopeless grandmother. I like them when they grow up. You don't leave small children with me. I always got, as my eldest son says, staff. Always somebody looked after their nonsenses. I don't like this repetitive, please do this, please don't be rude. I can't be dealing with all that. And actually, I tell them I like the dog best.
On that note, let's have your final piece of music. What are we going to hear?
You're going to hear my friend, Jessie Norman, who has influenced me a lot in the last 20, 30 years. We've had a good friendship.
And she sang at a very special occasion for you. Tell me about that.
She sang, not this, but she sang when the ward was named after me in a moment of Brompton charm. And she sang at Walter's memorial service as a friend.
That was Richard Strauss's Zu Ayagnung, sung by Jessie Norman with the Gewandhaus Orchestra Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Masur. So I'm going to give you the books now, Jane. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book along. What would you like to take?
I want the whole volume of Baroness Orks's Scarlet Pimpernel.
And a luxury too.
Well, if I can't have a hot bath every day, I'll have frette sheets.
No, we can manage a hot bath every day, yes. Any sort of special oils or unguents or bubbles, or do you like a plain bath?
No, I like Rose Geranium by Floris.
Ah, well, we shall give you that too. And one track to save from the eight.
I think I'd save Jessie.
Right, it's yours. Jane Somerville, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for asking me. It's wonderful. Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.